KZSU, Stanford University. Welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I am a resident fellow at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School, and thank you for joining me today. Today I'm pleased to have on the author of a book called The Transparent Society, subtitled Will Technology Force Us to Choose Between Privacy and Freedom? The author is David Brin, the noted science fiction author who wrote this book in 1998, or it came out in 1998. It's somewhat unusual to be able to interview an author about a book that is almost 10 years old, especially in the technological world, given how technology is developing and how thought is developing with regard to that technology. But in The Transparent Society, David has written a book of exceptional presence, and a book that amazingly is not only quite relevant today, but in some ways is more relevant, given what his focus is. His focus is, as the title suggests, the transparent society. And the question is, what does technology do to people, and what does it do to society generally in two specific areas, as he says in his subtitle, privacy and freedom. There are many, many areas that are covered in this book, and this is one of those books that is simply impossible to cover in all of its breadth in 1 hour, or even if we talked for 24 hours. But we are going to dive into the major themes of David Brin's book, as well as taking a look at some of the interesting ideas that he discusses in some detail in the book, as well as taking a look perhaps a little bit into the crystal ball, which I always hesitate doing, and it's always unfair, but hopefully David will entertain my efforts to attempt to get some predictions on the future. But interestingly, I do want to open up with a general and very quick overview of why David Brin's book is particularly useful today. We, and anyone who's listened to the show knows, are in a society focused on secrecy. That is something that more and more is a focus. I discuss it at great length. Clearly, we see what's happening in the world generally, and what certainly governments are trying to do to tamp down information. That's always been something that government has wanted to do. There's nothing new about that. And you can go all the way back to the dawn of democracy and find governments that really had a general view that the public's job was simply to stay out of the way and let the governing govern by themselves. And we are not in a society which values secrecy the same way that it was valued, say, 100 years ago or 200 years ago. But there is clearly a drive towards more secrecy, less transparency, certainly at the federal level in the United States, and perhaps even at the state level. And one of the interesting developments that we can find and that we can discuss in discussing the book, The Transparent Society, is what does technology do to that dynamic? Is it in fact true, for example, that technology increases openness and that therefore the decision-making process is improved? Are things like personal reputation, something that David discusses in his book, in fact benefited, or are they hampered? And is the formation of one's reputation hampered by the amount of information that's made public? So these are all very exciting questions, very challenging questions. And for that reason, I'm very excited to have David Brin, author of the book, The Transparent Society, on the show today. And for people that are not as familiar with his writing, David is an author. He also studied comets and spacecraft design and has taught university physics and writing courses. But he's won multiple Hugo, Nebula, and ALA awards for books including Star Tide Rising, The Uplift War, The Postman, and Earth. He began his scientific training at Caltech and received a PhD from the University of California. So without further ado, we're going to go to a short music break. And when we return, we'll start the conversation with David Brin, author of the book, The Transparent Society, on KZSU's Hearsay Culture.
If I have done my job properly, at the other end of the line is David Brin. David, are you there?
I'm here, and hi.
Terrific. Thank you so much for being here today, and thanks again for your patience scheduling the show. Let's jump right in and start the conversation by discussing what the title Transparent Society means.
Well, it has to do with the fact that people have called it Brin's corollary to Moore's Law. A lot of people are familiar with Moore's Law, that the amount of computing power that we have available continues to skyrocket as time goes on. But there's also something going on with cameras, and I started writing the Transparent Society when I lived in England about 12, 13 years ago, and there were 150,000 CCD cameras reporting to the police on what was going on in neighborhoods and on streets because people had a real steep hooliganism problem there. And the cameras were very popular because it was making the streets safe again. And yet, at the same time, people were deeply worried that we might be heading towards Big Brother. The chilling image in Orwell's 1984 of the telescreen where the state could look and see everybody, but nobody could look back. And it occurred to me that there was a corollary to Moore's law, and that is that the cameras are increasing in their power every year. Every year there are more cameras, they are smaller, they are more accurate, they are cheaper, and they are pervading our world at an incredible rate. And either this will result in a huge empowerment of Big Brother in and elites in our world, or it suddenly occurred to me, how did we get our freedom? We got our freedom not by hiding from elites, but by controlling the elites, by becoming people who were able to look back. And the fundamental thing about our civilization is that we're the first in which the average man and woman have at least a chance of holding the mighty accountable. And it is this notion of reciprocal accountability, our ability to hold each other accountable, that is at the root of all of our enlightenment institutions, all of the things that have enabled us to be free and creative people. So that's what transparency is about. It's not about us going around naked. Sometimes people oversimplify and say I'm against privacy. Nothing could be farther from the truth. I like my own privacy. I think that we need to remember where privacy comes from. It comes from the ability of each of us to hold accountable those who violate our privacy.
The idea of transparency is one that has a long lineage, and going back to Jeremy Bentham and various utilitarian writers. I'm curious, given your background as a science fiction writer, but also someone highly trained in science generally, how did you come to focus on these issues?
Well, one is always motivated by a sense of danger that civilization is in. There, if you take a look at the failure modes of the past, you know, Santayana said those who ignore the past are doomed to repeat it. I'm appalled by the cliches that we cling to, like the notion that free markets have only one kind of enemy, and that's socialism. Well, we grew up with a massive socialist evil empire over the horizon, and so we tend to assume this. And so our friends, who may be conservative or libertarian, are completely unable to look across 4,000 years of history and realize that vastly more free markets were destroyed by kings, by cronies of the king, by aristocrats and feudal lords, than were ever harmed by socialism. As a matter of fact, the person who was inarguably the first liberal, Adam Smith, if he were alive today, he would instantly recognize the failure modes that are ruining capitalism and markets in America and the West today, and he would say, hey, these are the cronies of the king, just as in my day. He would have no fear of communists. He would fear the cronies of the king. It's this necessity for us to step back and say, what is the underlying pattern that got us what we have and that can get us more? And left versus right, these cliches of left versus right aren't helpful. What's helpful is to say, this is the first civilization in human history that has actually empowered individual people to stand up, look each other in the eye, and even look the mighty in the eye. And the operative word there is look.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No. That's fine. It's the word look means that we can see vision. Look, ever since glass lenses and movable type were invented in the 1400s, every generation of human beings in the West has faced an eruption of new technology that has had several interesting effects. Movable type increased our access to knowledge. In effect, the printing press was an augmentation or an extrapolation, a prosthetic device for expanding human memory. Eyeglasses and microscopes and telescopes expanded human vision. Perspective expanded human attention. These three things, vision, memory, and attention, have been expanded later on by public libraries, by television, by all sorts of prosthetic devices. And today we have this proliferation of cameras everywhere, mm-hmm. and databases. And every single generation has worried that human beings can't cope with this, can't cope with this new godlike power to see and to know and to remember and to perceive and to divide our attention ever more. And every single time there were pundits who said, we must back off. We must trust authority figures to see for us, to know for us, to make these decisions for us. And fortunately, every single generation of Western civilization decided, no, we're going to share this with everybody. Mm-hmm. And it's always been the right decision.
One of the challenges of writing a book like yours, and something that I do want to get into, you've raised the specter, and I agree that the dichotomy between left and right are rather facile and increasingly meaningless if you want to discuss these issues at any depth. But I am curious, since you raised it, before I get into really a core thesis, or perhaps you could wind this into the question. When we talk about the idea of people being able to share information, clearly technology makes that a lot easier. But this isn't the first time that we have instances where, as you mentioned, technology has changed and allowed for greater dissemination of information and sharing of information, and ultimately removing some of the power from the established entities that pervade media and what have you. My question is, aside from the core thesis of the book, which you got into, how do you see us in 2007 having technology that allows for both the privacy and the freedom that you described as being somewhat at odds in our society today?
Well, you know, given a choice between privacy and accountability, people always choose privacy and secrecy as a power for their side, and accountability for those they fear most, for their enemies. It's human nature. We have a tendency to assume that if our side has power, naturally we have needs for secrecy, we have needs for privacy. But when we see our enemies keeping secrets, then they're plotting, then they're making plots. This is the way human beings are. I'm sometimes told that I claim that secrecy is the root of all evil. No. As a matter of fact, I consult with some defense agencies and with the government now and then about how to use secrecy properly, like, for instance, with expiration dates on all secrets so that the people can eventually hold everyone accountable. But the point is that secrecy is not the root of all evil. But I defy anybody out there to name an evil that is not made worse by secrecy.
And an interesting challenge, and perhaps we'll get some emails on that. It leads me into my next question, actually, which is your idea that you discuss in the book of underutilized tools of openness and light. And again, writing in 1998, things have changed to a pretty large degree since then. But again, looking at where we were both in 1998 and where we are now, can you describe some of those underutilized tools of openness and light that you think would add to the transparency that you seek, and why were they underutilized?
Well, you know, look, it is human nature for those who have power to seek more power. This is what spoiled every free market in the past, every glimmering of tolerance and egalitarianism. And you notice I'm pressing button words that are right-wing button words and left-wing button words, because if we can get past left and right, we can see that it's not so much about left and right, it's about future versus past. It's about pragmatism versus fanaticism. And there are would-be tyrants of the left and would-be tyrants of the right who want us indignant, in an indignant fury at each other, instead of pragmatically negotiating with each other. And one of the things that you need in order to pragmatically negotiate with other people is knowledge. You need to be able to know. And this is the fundamental of the, what I call the four accountability arenas. Democracy, science, markets, and courts. You cannot imagine any of these four things working properly if some of the participants are denied knowledge. They have to make informed decisions for markets to work well, for democracy to work well, for science to work well, for courts to work well. This is fundamental. It's one of the basic aspects of Western civilization. And we're seeing it undermined right and left. For example, in the topic of intellectual property.
Mm-hmm.
There are so many people who own intellectual... I own plenty. My novels, like The Postman, naturally I wanted to protect my intellectual property when I sold it to Paramount for that movie. I have patents. But people are forgetting the fundamental root reason why intellectual property was invented in the first place. It was not invented because there is some sacred right to own knowledge. That is absurd. It was invented as a totally pragmatic tool for bribing creative people to stop keeping their creations secret. In the old guilds and in the old crafts, people would discover a new technique of metalworking or something like that, and they would keep it secret so that their competitors wouldn't get it. And this slowed civilization down. The whole purpose of patents is to say, here's a bribe called royalties. Come out and share it immediately, now. Any time intellectual property serves the function of slowing down the commerce of ideas, we need to rethink how it works. We need to rethink the whole underpinnings of laws and come up with a new approach.
The intellectual property element is obviously one with which I'm familiar, and I do want to, you've said a lot that I could follow up on. I do want to follow up on a couple of points that you made, which is this tension between secrecy and the ability of people to make the right decisions and for the institutions that you mentioned to function properly. One of the, at the same time that that point is perhaps well taken, you've also conceded that there are times where secrecy is important and in fact necessary. And whether it's in arenas such as national security or whether it's in the arena of security is a big one, but whether it's in the arena of security or in other arenas like competitiveness and the ability of companies to be able to capture wealth, how do you reconcile those two points?
Well, you know, it's you need, I just have to reiterate, you need knowledge in order to hold others accountable. We're entering an era in which some people believe we're going to see the return of the village. Now, let me explain what the village is. We're entering an era in which, you know, these little stickers that kids have, they can buy, you know, $10 for a roll of stickers.
Mm-hmm.
Stickers are maybe a tenth of a cent each. They stick them all over lampposts. You find them all over your house. They're a little irritating and cute. In 10 years, a child is going to have a roll of these stickers, and they're going to be called penny cans. The moment you unpeel it, the battery, year-long battery, is activated. Each one has an address on IPv6 cyberspace. They'll be stuck all over our cities. What are you going to do under those circumstances? You're going to, there will be laws passed to ban them. And as Robert Heinlein said, the only thing achieved by privacy laws is to make the bugs smaller. Look, you're going to have on the corner of your eyeglasses a little camera, or your eyeglasses or your sunglasses. In Werner Vinge's great new novel, Rainbow's End, it's even in a contact lens that you have. You're going to be walking down the street, and it's going to scan people's faces as they go by, look them up on registries, and provide captions on the inner surface of the contact lens of the eyeglass, basically identifying everybody who's walking past you. Not only their names, but depending upon how you dialed your glasses and your preferences, you may get the first sentence of their public profile that they want out there, or you might have tuned your glasses to give dissenting opinions from their ex-spouses, or to put mustaches on everybody walking by. This is called augmented reality, and we are going to head towards this godlike power added to our other godlike powers. If you don't think you already have godlike powers, when was the last time you saw an event happening live far around the world, or when was the last time you flew through the sky?
Uh-huh.
Every time we have gotten these godlike powers, people have wrung their hands and moaned about how it was the end of everything, and then they got used to them. So, you know, I spoke of prosthetics, about how eyeglasses and telescopes and printing presses were prosthetics that expanded human vision and expanded human memory. Well, think about this. You can currently know and recognize and remember the faces and reputations of anywhere from 1,000 to 10,000 people, depending on how talented you are. You see them on the street, you say, oh, who is that? Who is that? And it pops into mind. This happens to be the number that a gregarious person would have needed to know back in the days of the old villages that most of our ancestors grew up in, or the old tribes. Our brain is made to know about the same number of people and their reputations that we would have throughout our evolution. And so, in the ancient times, you would have shaken hands with a tradesman or a blacksmith or whatever, and that would have been enough for the deal, because you knew each other's reputations, and each of you was desperate to maintain your reputation. Well, now we carry reputation prosthetics in our pockets. We carry credit cards. We carry driver's licenses, IDs. We have credit ratings from Experian. Because we need prosthetics for reputation. We need prosthetics to recognize other people because we live in a vast, complex civilization. Well, imagine it's 20, 30 years from now and you're walking down the street in some far off, in Bangkok or someplace like that, and you have these captions under everybody, perhaps some, but you can even see their auras if one of them's a pedophile, known pedophile, or one of them's... You'll need less law under these circumstances. You'll need less protection from professionals. But also you'll be able to make business deals. You walk up to a shop in Bangkok and say, can you send 20 of these items to my sister's shop in Duluth? And he's looking up your sister's shop and her credit rating in real time, and you shake hands and your eyeglasses witness the handshake, and that's all you need. In other words, we're heading toward a world that's going to be very much more like the village that our ancestors knew, only it's going to be a village of 8 billion people.
The return of the village is another topic that you do discuss, and it leads me into a question which perhaps I will ask, and then we'll go into a short music break so we can continue the conversation with David Brin, author of the book The Transparent Society. So, David, I guess I'll ask the question, and then we'll have a music break, and you'll have time to think it through to the extent that you even need it. But one of the points that you make in the book is that while you do, I think, have a generally positive view of the possibility of maintaining a transparent society, although you've painted some ominous pictures in your answer to my last question. You point out that quote, the balance of common sense, unquote, and technology will result in a world where we are observed, quote-unquote, 80% of the time. And that seems like a high number, and I'm curious after the break to ask you if you see this as a sustainable amount of observation, and given, again, that your book was written in 1998, do you believe that, in fact, we're in a society where observation is at 80% or more or less? So I will ask that question and then leave it as a cliffhanger and go to a short music break. And after the music break, we will return with David Brin, author of the book The Transparent Society on KZSU Stanford. Somewhat ironically there, I'm using a bootleg, one of the authorized bootlegs that the Grateful Dead put out there of the song Dark Hollow. We started off with the classic Jackson Brown song Doctor My Eyes, and at the first music break, it was the Jayhawks with Stumbling Through the Dark. Before we return with David Brin, author of the book The Transparent Society, it's now the time on Hearsay Culture where I ask you for money, and I ask you if you like what you're hearing. Help make KZSU the station that allows the continuation of great programs without commercials to listeners all over the Bay Area and indeed all over the internet. The music, sports, news, and public affairs programming that people come to listen to on KZSU requires that donations come in. So for more information on making a donation, please email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Again, that's kzsu.stanford.edu. Or you can also go to the website, kzsu.stanford.edu, and click on Donate to KZSU. And, of course, don't forget to keep on listening. So we're back with David Brin. And, David, at the music break, I was asking you about your prediction that we will be observed 80% of the time. Where are we today?
I don't believe we're observed. It also depends on what you mean by observed. I mean, certainly there are sifting programs that are checking your email traffic and your online postings all the time, looking for keywords and all of that. Get used to it. When you're on the street, when you're in your car, you're passing through zones of security cameras. The big difference between the United Kingdom today, between Britain today, which used to have 150, I thought it was a lot when they had 150,000 cameras. Well, now they have about 2 million cameras spread across Britain. The difference is that there, those cameras are mostly official, reporting to hierarchical agencies. Whereas in America, most of the cameras are commercial or private. And so the FBI, at least ostensibly, needs a search warrant in order to get access to them. Nevertheless, I mean, the pervasion of cameras on the streets and all of that is unstoppable. If you outlaw them, you'll make them smaller and restrict the people who get to look through them to some elite. Pick whatever elite you don't like, government, big business, criminals, foreign spies, UFOs, whatever you like. The main effect of these privacy laws will be to ensure that you don't get to look through them. But this does not mean that we will have a complete end to privacy. In law, there is something called a curtilage, and that is a zone within which you are the king or queen of your castle, a zone within which you must feel some degree of serenity and privacy and safety just to feel human. I don't think that we will, if we have a transparent society, allow privacy to go away. The irony is we'll probably have more genuine privacy if we chill out and relax and welcome this new world, including the fact that we'll all be obligated to open our eyes and see most of the time. Because if we're a people who know most of what's going on most of the time, then our privacy will not be violated systematically. You see what I mean?
Yeah, I do, and it's an interesting point because I think one of the fascinating points that you raise is this idea that you define as reciprocal transparency, which I'll allow you to define. The trade-off that you're describing there is an interesting one, and it's something that you've discussed here quite a bit, discussing the nature of power and how power ultimately allows you to make the rules, and therefore have control over these devices that may in one way or another invade your privacy and at the same time allow for secrecy with regard to how the information is disseminated. My question is, aside from defining reciprocal transparency, which I think is a fascinating point that you discuss in the book. Again, since 1998, we have the advent of wikis, we have the pervasive nature of blogs, the growth of podcasts, and indeed the increased availability of the internet to people that certainly in 1998 wouldn't have had access by way of municipal Wi-Fi and things like that. In light of that expansion, do you think reciprocal transparency is in fact what's occurring today?
I think that as with all times in Western civilization, and especially the American Great Experiment, there is great tension. Certainly what we have seen in this century so far has been a pulling back from the challenges of our Great Experiment. I thought in 1999 that, you know, people were worried about whether or not there might be not only the Y2K computer problem with the double zeros and causing airplanes to fall out of the sky, but a worse Y2K problem of people being traumatized by the sudden arrival of the future, of a new century, of a new millennium. At the time when 2000 came, everybody shrugged and said, well, I guess that was fear was for nothing. I'm looking back at the last 6 or 7 years, and I realize that I think that we've been completely neurotic. I think we went completely insane in 2000, and we're only now starting to regain our senses and realize that the future is the main topic that should be on our agenda.
Right.
As Jonas Salk said, the principal job of any decent human being is to be a good ancestor. And taking care that our great-grandchildren bless us and don't curse us should be our number one agenda. Now, if that sounds a little bit liberal lefty, fine. I was trying to defend free market, mm-hmm. but I don't think there's any doubt in anybody's mind that at this point, any reasonable person, that we have not been showing very good sense, and I think we need to step back and realize that the genius of our civilization has been our ability to negotiate with each other.
And how does the reciprocal, for those that aren't familiar with the book, your definition of reciprocal transparency, how does that fit into that ethic?
Well, it's not so much reciprocal transparency as it is reciprocal accountability.
Okay. And how would you define that?
Hold each other accountable. And we have to watch out for this tendency that we always have to assume that our side doesn't need to be held accountable. Our side does not benefit from criticism. One of my favorite aphorisms is, criticism is the only known antidote to error. Even if your side is 90% right and the other side is 90% wrong, that still leaves you an option for treating them with honor and saying, all right, I'll concede this point if you'll concede these. And it's a much more effective way to deal with people. It's how liberals should be reaching out to the decent conservatives in America today in order to draw them away from their coalition with monsters.
Ultimately, do you think that technology, this technology that I was mentioning, the wikis, the blogs, the ability for people to self-publish, does that balance the playing field more so than the world as it existed in 1998?
I got off a little bit from that question, and basically what it is it's a tension right now between trends that are very, very positive, where this new augmentation of godlike powers that started with glass lenses and movable type is entering into a new era when you'll have vast amounts of information And not only the information that you'll get from Google and the next layer of Google and the next version of Google, but analytical tools where you'll be able to get the information and massage it and analyze it in real time. You'll be able to grab the glacier information from the planet and analyze it with your own tools to see if global warming, if Al Gore is right, while watching his film in real time. These are all very, very powerful. Unfortunately, some of the people in your neck of the woods in Silicon Valley have, I think, been making a terrible mistake and doing more harm than good by saying that all we need is vast floods of information, that we'll have this wonderful smart mob arrangement where people just leap all over problems and attack any proto-tyranny just because there's a huge amount of information out there and a vast ability to talk. Well, I don't think that blogs and talking are enough. We need to be able to use these new tools to negotiate and draw conclusions. Just everybody screaming their opinions at the top of their lungs online is nowhere near enough to be able to get us out of this mess, because there are always forces on the other side.
What additional tools do you think are necessary to make sense of it? Because clearly we do have a flood of information. And in fact, just a few weeks ago, I had on the show Richard Lanham, the author of The Economics of Attention from UCLA, where he's talking about this very issue, that there is a flood of information, but that then the question becomes attention and the ability of people to get through that information. So merely putting all the information out there isn't enough. What additional tools do you think are necessary in order to allow this flood of information to achieve the goals that you propose in your book?
Well, the economics of attention, I think, is one of the most insightful notions in many, many years. Say, for instance, we get nanotechnology and wonderful new advances, and the solar roofs rescue us from many crises and things like this. We have a cornucopia of wealth. What's going to be the last thing that is rare and scarce? Human attention, which ironically may bring us to Marx's economy of the labor theory of value, but that's another story entirely. The point is that limited human attention span is already the huge bottleneck on the internet. It turns out that I've just patented 126 claims having to do with ways to divide human attention online. So I've been very concerned about this issue. I've been engaged in it already. I think another tool that would be very useful beyond helping us divide our attention would be arenas online where people with diverse points of view would be forced, not forced by law, but forced by honor, to come and systematically experience criticism of the thing that they have been ranting that everyone should do.
So fighting the echo chamber, as it were.
Yeah, I call these disputation arenas. And they would be systematic approaches to exposing ideas to relentless and agreed upon methods of ritual combat between ideas and their proponents. It's a weird idea, but I think that it would bring us some of the accountability that we see in markets and democracy and courts. Another breakthrough that I think is terribly important is in the area of prediction. Our prefrontal lobes, these little nubs just above our eyes, are the organs in our brain that we developed most recently, and they're the ones that peer into the future. They're where we do these little, what Einstein called Gedanken experiments, thought experiments. What will people say if I repeat this rumor by the water cooler today? What will people say if I wear this to work? What will happen if I try to run this yellow light? We do thought experiments in the future, and we're obsessed with the future, and 10% of our economy goes into trying to figure out what's happening next with business models and weather prediction and politics and all of that sort of thing. The problem is that I think that the internet internet could be used to track who's been right and who's been wrong. And now there are some moves in this direction with what are called prediction markets, and I'm involved in some of that, but I think it's a mistaken direction to try to push this in, and I think that trying to find ways to simply find out who's been right a lot. I mean, you know, the guy who predicted that Saddam would invade Kuwait, was he rewarded? No, he was fired.
Uh-huh.
And everybody who predicted disaster in Iraq, the second Iraq war, has been fired. That's a hell of a way to run a civilization's decision-making process.
These are all interesting ideas, and recognizing the fact that they're cutting edge, I do want to push back on it a little bit to get your thoughts. Because let me take just the basic operation of a blog and ask you your response to this. If I make a blog entry and I say, David Brin is dead wrong, and everything he said is wrong, as long as I open up my blog entry to comments, I offer the opportunity right there to have the disputational arena that you're suggesting. And I can give people the opportunity to say, no, Levine, you're wrong, and Brin's absolutely right. So I'm using a very basic example, but I guess I want to ask you a little bit in more detail, to the extent that you can discuss it, what a disputational arena would look like. Is it, you mentioned honor, and of course the question is, how does one regulate honor? But it maybe a little more detail, describe what this arena would look like in the internet world and how it differs from the blog entry comment process.
Well, it's a very interesting question. I had a lead article in the American Bar Association Journal of Dispute Resolution about this. You have to understand that people responding with comments on a blog, and I have a very popular blog online, Contrary Brin, and very bright people come and they apply criticism, the only note antidote to error, and it's all very welcome. When you make a point in a comment section on a blog and people go, huh, well, that was pretty good, you responded pretty well to that, it's floating there in the air for a second or two, people go, huh. Maybe one or two people jot down a point, and then it's gone. Your refutation has not actually accomplished anything. In a market, when you turn away from a product, there is a feedback loop that goes into the economy that actually has effect. When a court makes a ruling, it actually has an effect. When people make science experiments and announce the results in a peer adjudicated journal, it has an effect. These other four accountability arenas, and I should include democracy as well, have been developed for 400 years, and they have great sophistication and pattern to how they adjudicate the truth that they're looking for. In markets, it's economic truth. In democracy, it's policy. In science, it's objective truth, and they have ways of overcoming the immaturities of human nature. The net has none of that. The net caters to the immaturities of human nature. We scream, we form little Nuremberg rallies of common interest in which we go Sieg Heil to the left or Sieg Heil to the right. When was the last time you saw the internet actually result in people cohesively deciding, well, that was a bad idea? The fact that so many bright people think we're already there actually appalls me. I don't see anything happening on the internet that has actually changed our direction in the last 10 years.
When you say what directions are you referring to?
I mean that the internet should be one of the products that comes out of the new economy of the internet should be the disreputization of really bad ideas. Instead everybody says, well, this storm of ideas, all of them being yelled at each other at the same time, is somehow wonderful. Look, let me explain.
Yeah.
Democracy, markets, courts, and science, they have a cycle to them. First, you have a centrifugal phase in which people separate into safe zones and prepare their product. In markets, it's companies. In science, it's your tenured professorship and laboratories. In democracy, it's political parties. In courts, it is the attorney-client privilege. But then there is a centripetal call to battle, a battle that they cannot avoid. The marketplace is calling the companies together. They have to meet, they have to bring their product to the marketplace. In courts, you have to battle it out in courts. In democracy, there are elections. There is no equivalent centripetal phase for the Internet.
It's an interesting idea. I do, and we don't have a lot of time left. I do want to push back for a second on that, and then really ask a sum up question to what has been a fascinating and very provocative discussion. I'm not sure that I agree that the Internet hasn't changed ideas generally, and you could look at it at a micro level and a meta level, and the one instance that came to mind was during the presidential campaign and the memos regarding President Bush's service in the National Guard and the CBS story that, you know, involving Dan Rather. And in fact, it were Internet sleuths who took a close look at this document and made the assertion initially that the document itself was a fraud, at least in a public sense. And in that way, that particular document was undermined. Now, that's not the same as changing a paradigm or a view that people have of the world. But it is a beginning to see that we can push information through to actually change people's perception of the world around them vis-a-vis the technology. Is that a bad comparison or a wrong comparison?
You can send a particular missile at a particular spot and every now and then hit a target, especially if that target is honorable. Then they have to back off. I haven't seen similar refutations of the people now in power have any effect whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you refute something that they say, you refute something that they've done, it just floats around and just bounces right off them. The Internet uses spitballs.
Uh-huh.
And that's basically the level of maturity that it has right now, too.
Do you think that as more people get access to the Internet, those spitballs, by virtue of the amount of people who have access to it, will become cannonballs?
Well, the exciting place where the real action is taking place is the Third World. I've long been a booster of Project Witness, which has sent video cameras to activists, freedom activists, and all of that all over the world, to help them use the power of vision and cameras and transparency to hold their local elites accountable. Well, now, all through the Third World, where there are lousy wired phone systems, cell phones are booming, doubling the number of people who have cell phones every year or two. And now they are coming equipped with cameras. Pretty soon, when your average third world person has a cell phone with audio recording capability and video and all of that, this is going to have a profound effect upon local corruption.
Mm-hmm. And I think that actually is a good point to end on, because we are pushing towards the end here. David, I think that first of all, thank you for provocatively putting your ideas forth, and I think it's certainly engendered a lot of thought for me and things that I want to follow up on, and I appreciate you taking the time. You did mention your website, Contrary Brin, and you also have a website, davidbrin.com, which I encourage listeners to take a look at to learn more about these issues. David, I want to thank you for being on the show today and taking the time on Hearsay Culture at KZSU. It's been a great discussion, and my commendations and kudos for writing a very provocative and sustaining book.
Well, thank you. And you know, the Transparent Society is just part of, you know, what a conversation with everybody out there. And thank you for providing a show that lets me actually talk at length at some of these things.
I appreciate it. I certainly am happy to do it, and perhaps in the future come back on and we can continue the discussion.
Terrific.
I want to thank David Brin again for being on the show and discussing his book, Transparent Society, Will Technology Force Us to Choose Between Privacy and Freedom? I'm very excited to mention some upcoming guests. This show is being recorded on February 20th, 2007. But coming up next week on the schedule as I've set it up is Professor Richard Epstein, who has a very, very different view, I think, of society than the one that David Brin has just put forth. I'm excited to have Professor Epstein on to discuss his views of technology and the world and regulation in particular, and to have a far-reaching discussion with Professor Epstein, as well as the following week with Professor Eric Goldman of Santa Clara University School of Law, who's also the director of their High Tech Law Institute, to discuss some of the interesting work that he's doing in the world of trademark and internet regulation as well. Hearsay Culture, of course, can be heard not only on KZSU live from 5 to 6 p.m. on Wednesdays, PST, but also through both the CIS, the Center for Internet and Society webpage at cyberlaw.stanford.edu, as well as the new website for Hearsay Culture, which you can find at hearsayculture.com. From both of these resources, as well as the iTunes webpage for the Center for Internet and Society, you will find not only Hearsay Culture, but on the iTunes page and CIS page also other events that are occurring at CIS, which I commend you to, as there's always interesting people coming through and talking about their ideas at Stanford. So thank you again, David, for being on the show. Thank you, everyone, for listening to Hearsay Culture and supporting the show. I always encourage you to email me at dave@hearsayculture.com for any thoughts, suggestions, comments. Otherwise, I leave you with the classic that I began with, the Jackson Brown tune, Doctor My Eyes. And please stay tuned to KZSU for Mike and Baptism of Solitude. Have a great day.